Jocelyn in regards to her sons. You simply must. You can't fight against it. I wish I had. I wish I'd given up early and hedged my bets, as it were. Because they're your father's teeth, you see. Wisdom teeth are passed down by the father. I'm certain of it. So, you must be big enough for them. God knows I wasn't big enough for mine. Have them out, and brush 3 times a day, if my advice means anything. By the time Mr. J.P. Hamilton looked down to see whether his advice meant anything, his 3 dun-colored visitors had already disappeared, taking with them the bag of apples, apples he had been contemplating asking Jocelyn to put through the food processor, tripping over themselves, running to get to a green space, to get to one of the lungs of the city, some place where free breathing was possible. Now, the children knew the city, and they knew the city breeds the mad. They knew Mr. Whiteface, an Indian who walks the streets of Willesden with his face painted white, his lips painted blue, wearing a pair of tights and some hiking boots. They knew Mr. Newspaper, a tall skinny man in an ankle-length raincoat, who sits in Brent Libraries removing the day's newspapers from his briefcase and methodically tearing them into strips. They knew Mad Mary, a black voodoo woman with a red face, whose territory stretches from Kilburn to Oxford Street, but who performs her spells from a bin in West Hampstead. They knew Mr. Toupet, who has no eyebrows and wears a toupee not on his head, but on a string around his neck. But these people announced their madness. They were better, less scary than Mr. J.P. Hamilton. They flaunted their insanity. They weren't half mad and half not, curled around a doorframe. They were properly mad in the Shakespearean sense, talking sense when you least expected it. In North London, where councillors once voted to change the name of the area to Nirvana, it is not unusual to walk the streets and be suddenly confronted by sage words from the chalk-faced, blue-lipped, or eyebrowless. From across the street, or from the other end of a tube carriage, they will use their schizophrenic talent for seeing connections in the random, for discerning the whole world in a grain of sand, for deriving narrative from nothing, to riddle you, to rhyme you, to strip you down, to tell you who you are and where you're going. Usually Baker Street, the great majority of modern-day seers travel the Metropolitan Line. And why? But as a city, we are not appreciative of these people. Our gut instinct is that they intend to embarrass us, that they're out to shame us somehow as they lurch down the train aisle, bulbous-eyed and with carbuncled nose, preparing to ask us inevitably what we are looking at. What the fuck are we looking at? As a kind of preemptive defense mechanism, Londoners have learned not to look, never to look, to avoid eyes at all times so that the dreaded question, what you looking at, and its pitiful, gutless, useless answer, nothing, might be avoided. But as the prey evolves, and we are prey to the mad who are pursuing us, desperate to impart their own brand of truth to the hapless commuter, so does the hunter. And the true professionals begin to tire of that old catchphrase, what you looking at, and move into more exotic territory. Take Mad Mary. Oh, the principle's still the same. It's still all about eye contact and the danger of making it, but now she's making eye contact from 100, 200, even 300 yards away. And if she catches you doing the same, she roars down the street, dreads and feathers and cape afloat, hoodoo stick in hand until she gets to where you are, spits on you, and begins. Samad knew all of this. They'd had dealings before, he and red-faced Mad Mary. He even suffered the misfortune of having her sit next to him on a bus. Any other day, and Samad would have given her as good as he got. But today, he was feeling guilty and vulnerable. Today, he was holding Poppy's hand as the sun crept away. He could not face Mad Mary and her vicious truth-telling, her ugly madness, which of course was precisely why she was stalking him, quite deliberately stalking him down Church Road.
"For your own safety, don't look," said Samad. "Just keep on walking in a straight line. I had no idea she travelled this far into Harlesden."
Poppy snatched the quickest glance at the multicoloured streaming flash galloping down the high street on an imaginary horse. She laughed. "Who is that?" Samad quickened the pace.
"She is Mad Mary, and she is not remotely funny. She is dangerous."
"Oh, don't be ridiculous. Just because she's homeless and has mental health difficulties doesn't mean she wants to hurt anyone. Poor woman. Can you imagine what must have happened in her life to make her like that?"
Samad sighed.
"First of all, she is not homeless. She has stolen every wheelie bin in West Hampstead and has built quite a significant structure out of them in Fortune Green. And secondly, she is not a poor woman. Everyone is terrified of her. From the council downwards, she receives free food from every corner shop in North London ever since she cursed the Ramachandra place and business collapsed within the month."
Samad's portly figure was working up quite a sweat now, as he shifted another gear in response to Mad Mary doing the same on the other side of the street. Breathless, he whispered,
"And she doesn't like white people."
Poppy's eyes widened.
"Really?"
she said, as if such an idea had never occurred to her, and turned round to make the fatal mistake of looking. In a second, Mad Mary was upon them. A thick globule of spit hit Samad directly between his eyes on the bridge of his nose. He wiped it away, pulled Poppy to him, and tried to sidestep Mad Mary by ducking into the courtyard of St. Andrew's Church, but the hoodoo stick slammed down in front of them both, marking a line in the pebbles and dust that could not be crossed over. She spoke slowly, and with such a menacing scowl that the left side of her face seemed paralyzed.
"You looking at some thing?"
Poppy managed a squeak.
"No."
Mad Mary whacked Poppy's calf with the hoodoo stick and turned to Samad.
"You, sir, you looking at some thing?"
Samad shook his head.
Suddenly, she was screaming, "Black man, them block you everywhere you turn." "Please," stuttered Poppy, clearly terrified. "We don't want any trouble. Black man?"
She liked to speak in rhyming couplets.
"The bitch she wish to see you burn."
"We are minding our own business," began Samad,
but he was stopped by a second projectile of phlegm, this time hitting him on the cheek.
"True hill and gully, them follow you, them follow you. True hill and gully, the devil swallow you, him swallow you."
This was delivered in a kind of singing stage whisper, accompanied by a dance from side to side, arms outstretched and hoodoo stick resting firmly underneath Poppy Burt Jones' chin.
"What has them ever done for us, body, but kill us and enslave us? What has them done for our minds, but hurt us and enrage us? What's the pollution?"
Mad Mary lifted Poppy's chin with her stick and asked again,
"What's the pollution?"
Poppy was weeping. "Please,
I don't know what you want me to...
Mad Mary sucked her teeth and turned her attention once more to Saman.
What's their solution?
I don't know.
Mad Mary slapped him around the ankles with her stick.
What's their solution, black man?
Mad Mary was a beautiful, a striking woman. A noble forehead, a prominent nose, ageless midnight skin, and a long neck that queens can only dream about. But it was her alarming eyes, which shot out an anger on the brink of total collapse that Samad was concentrated upon. Because he saw that they were speaking to him and him alone. Poppy had nothing to do with this. Mad Mary was looking at him with recognition. Mad Mary had spotted a fellow traveler. She had spotted the madman in him, which is to say, the prophet. He felt sure she had spotted the angry man, the masturbating man, the man stranded in the desert far from his sons, the foreign man in a foreign land caught between borders, the man who, if you push him far enough, will suddenly see sense. Why else had she picked him from a street full of people? Simply because she recognized him. Simply because they were from the same place, he and Mad Mary, which is to say, far away.
Satyagraha, said Samad, surprising himself with his own calmness.
Mad Mary, unused to having her interrogations answered, looked at him in astonishment.
What's the solution?
Satyagraha, it is Sanskrit for truth and firmness. Gandhiji's word. You see, he did not like passive resistance or civil disobedience.
Mad Mary was beginning to twitch and swear compulsively under her breath. But Samad sensed that in some way, this was Mad Mary listening. This was Mad Mary's mind trying to process words other than her own.
Those words weren't big enough for him. He wanted to show what we call weakness to be a strength. He understood that sometimes not to act is a man's greatest triumph. He was a Hindu. I am a Muslim. My friend here is...
A Roman Catholic, said Poppy shakily. Lapsed.
And you are?
Began Samad.
Mad Mary said, cunt, bitch, rasclat, several times and spat on the floor, which Samad took as a sign of cooling hostilities. What I am trying to say...
Samad looked at the small group of Methodists who, hearing the noise, had begun to gather nervously at the door of St. Andrew's. He grew confident.
There had always been a monkey preacher in Samad, a know-it-all, a walker and a talker. With a small audience and a lot of fresh air, he had always been able to convince himself that all the knowledge in the universe, all the knowledge on walls, was his.
I am trying to say that life is a broad church, is it not?
He pointed to the ugly red brick building full of its quivering believers.
With wide aisles.
He pointed to the smelly bustle of black, white, brown and yellow shuffling up and down the high street. To the albino woman who stood outside the cash and carry, selling daisies picked from the churchyard.
Which my friend and I would like to continue walking along, if it is all right with you. Believe me, I understand your concerns,
said Samad, taking his inspiration now from that other great North London street preacher, Ken Livingstone.
I am having difficulties myself. We are all having difficulties in this country. This country, which is new to us and old to us all at the same time. We are divided people, aren't we?
And here, Samad did what no one had done to Mad Mary for well over 15 years. He touched her, very lightly, on the shoulder.
We are split people. For myself, half of me wishes to sit quietly with my legs crossed, letting the things that are beyond my control wash over me. But the other half wants to fight the holy war. Jihad!
And certainly we could argue this out in the street, but I think in the end, your past is not my past, and your truth is not my truth, and your solution, it is not my solution. So I do not know what it is you would like me to say. Truth and firmness is one suggestion, though there are many other people you can ask if that answer does not satisfy. Personally, my hope lies in the last days. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, tells us that on the day of resurrection, everyone will be struck unconscious. Deaf and dumb, no chit-chat, tongueless. And what a bloody relief that will be. Now, if you will excuse me.
Samad took Poppy firmly by the hand and walked on, while Mad Mary stood dumbstruck only briefly before rushing to the church door and spraying saliva upon the congregation. Poppy wiped away a frightened tear and sighed. She said,
"Calm in a crisis. Impressive."
Samad, increasingly given to visions, saw that great-grandfather of his, Mangal Pandey, flailing with a musket, fighting against the new, holding on to tradition.
"It runs in the family," he said.
Later, Samad and Poppy walked up through Harleston, around Dollis Hill, and then, when it seemed they were hovering too near to Wilsdon, Samad waited till the sun went down, bought a box of sticky Indian sweets, and turned into Roundwood Park, admired the last of the flowers. He talked and talked, the kind of talking you do to stave off the inevitable physical desire, the kind of talking that only increases it. He told her about Delhi, circa 1942. She told him about St. Albans, circa 1972. She complained about a long list of entirely unsuitable boyfriends, and Samad, not able to criticize Alsana or even mention her name, spoke of his children. Fear of Millat's passion for obscenities and a noisy TV show about an A-team. Worries about whether Majid got enough direct sunlight. What was the country doing to his sons? He wanted to know what was it doing.
"I like you," she said finally. "A lot. You're very funny. Do you know that you're funny?"
Samad smiled and shook his head.
"I have never thought of myself as a great comic wit."
"No, you are funny. That thing you said about camels..."
She began to laugh, and her laugh was infectious.
"What thing?" "About camels, when we were walking."
"Oh, you mean men are like camels. There is barely one in 100 that you would trust with your life."
"Yes."
"That's not comedy. That is the Bukhari, part 8, page 130, said Samad. "And it is good advice. I have certainly found it to be true."
"Well, it's still funny."
She sat closer to him on the bench and kissed his ear.
"Seriously, I like you."
"I'm old enough to be your father. I'm married. I am a Muslim."
"Okay, so Dateline wouldn't have matched our forms. So what?"
"What kind of a phrase is this? So what? Is that English? That is not English. Only the immigrants can speak the Queen's English these days."
Poppy giggled.
"I still say. So..."
But Samad covered her mouth with his hand and looked for a moment almost as if he intended to hit her.
"So everything. So everything. There is nothing funny about this situation. There is nothing good about it. I do not wish to discuss the rights or wrongs of this with you. Let us stick to what we are obviously here for," he spat out. "The physical, not the metaphysical."
Poppy moved to the other end of the bench and leant forward, her elbows resting on her knees.
I know, she began slowly, that this is no more than it is. But I won't be spoken to like that.
I am sorry. It was wrong of me.
Just because you feel guilty. I have nothing to feel.
Yes, I'm sorry. I have no.
Because you can go if you
half thoughts. Stick them all together, and you have less than you began with.
I don't want to go. I want you.
Poppy brightened a bit, and smiled a half-sad, half-goofy smile.
I want to spend the night with you.
Good, she replied. Because I bought this for you, while you were next door, buying those sugary sweets.
What is it?
She dived into her handbag, and in the attenuated minute in which she scrabbled through lipsticks and car keys and spare change, two things happened. 1.1. Samad closed his eyes and heard the words, "To the pure, all things are pure." And then, almost immediately afterwards, "Can't say fairer than that." 1.2. Samad opened his eyes and saw quite clearly by the bandstand his two sons, their white teeth biting into two waxy apples, waving, smiling. And then Poppy resurfaced, triumphant, with a piece of red plastic in her hand.
"A toothbrush," she said.
8. Mitosis.
The stranger who wanders into O'Connell's pool house at random, hoping for the soft rise and fall of his grandfather's brogue, perhaps, or seeking to rebound a red ball off the side cushion and into the corner pocket, is immediately disappointed to find the place is neither Irish nor a pool house. He will survey the carpeted walls, the reproductions of George Stubbs' racehorse paintings, the framed fragments of some foreign Eastern script, with not a little confusion. He will look for a snooker table and find instead a tall, brown man with terrible acne standing behind a counter, frying up eggs and mushrooms. His eyes will land with suspicion upon an Irish flag and a map of the Arab Emirates knotted together and hung from wall to wall, partitioning him from the rest of the customers. Then he will become aware of several pairs of eyes upon him, some condescending, some incredulous. The hapless stranger will stumble out, warily, backwards, knocking over the life-size cutout of Viv Richards as he goes. The customers will laugh. O'Connell's is no place for strangers. O'Connell's is the kind of place family men come to for a different kind of family. Unlike blood relations, it is necessary here to earn one's position in the community. It takes years of devoted fucking around, time-wasting, laying about, shooting the breeze, watching paint dry, far more dedication than men invest in the careless moment of procreation. You need to know the place. For example, there are reasons why O'Connell's is an Irish pool house run by Arabs with no pool tables. And there are reasons why the pustule-covered Mickey will cook you chips, egg and beans, or egg, chips and beans, or beans, chips, eggs, and mushrooms, but not, under any circumstances, chips, beans, eggs, and bacon. But you need to hang around for that kind of information. We'll get into that later. For now, suffice to say this is Archie's and Samad's home from home. For 10 years, they have come here between 6, the time Archie finishes work, and 8, the time Samad starts, to discuss everything from meaning of revelation to the prices of plumbers and women. hypothetical women. If a woman walked past the yolk-stained window of O'Connell's, a woman had never been known to venture inside. They would smile and speculate, depending on someone's religious sensibilities that evening, on matters as far-reaching as whether one would kick her out of bed in a hurry, to the relative merits of stockings or tights, and then on, inevitably, to the great debate. Small breasts that stand up versus big breasts that flop to the sides. But there was never any question of real women, real flesh and blood and wet and sticky women, not until now. And so the unprecedented events of the past few months called for an earlier O'Connell summit than usual. Samad had finally phoned Archie and confessed the whole terrible mess. He had cheated. He was cheating. He had been seen by the children. And now he was seeing the children like visions day and night. Archie had been silent for a bit and then said,
"Bloody hell. 4 o'clock it is, then. Bloody hell."
He was like that. Archie, calm in a crisis. But come 4:15, and still no sign of him. A desperate Samad had chewed every fingernail he possessed to the cuticle and collapsed on the counter, nose squished up against the hot glass where the battered burgers were kept, eye to eye with a postcard showing the 8 different local charms of County Antrim. Mickey, chef, waiter and proprietor, who prided himself on knowing each customer's name and knowing when each customer was out of sorts, prized Samad's face off the hot glass with an egg slice.
"Oi!"
"Hello, Mickey. How are you?"
"Same old, same old. But enough about me. What's the fucking matter with you, mate? Hey, hey? I've been watching you, Sammy, since the minute you stepped in here. Face as long as shit. Tell your Uncle Mickey."
Samad groaned.
"Oi, no, none of that. You know me, I'm the sympathetic side of the service industry. I'm service with a fucking smile. I'd wear a little red tie and a little red hat, like them fuckwits in Mr. Burger if my fucking head weren't so big."
This was not a metaphor. Mickey had a very large head, almost as if his acne had demanded more room and received planning permission.
"What's the problem?"
Samad looked up at Mickey's big red head.
"I am just waiting for Archibald, Mickey. Please, do not concern yourself. I will be fine."
"It's a bit early, isn't it?"
"Pardon?"
Mickey checked the clock behind him, the one with the paleolithic piece of encrusted egg on the dial.
"I say, it's a bit early, isn't it? For you and the Archie boy. 6 is when I expect you. 1 chips, beans, egg and mushroom, and 1 omelettes and mushrooms. But seasonal variations, naturally."
Samad sighed.
"We have much to discuss."
Mickey rolled his eyes.
"You ain't starting on that mangy-pandy whatever-the-fuckwits again, are you? Who shot who and who hung who? My granddad ruled the packies or whatever the fuck it was, as if any poor fucker gives a flying fuck. You're driving the custom away. You're creating..."
Mickey flicked through his new Bible, Food for Thought, a guideline for employers and employees working in the food service industry, customer strategy and consumer relations.
"You're creating a repetitive syndrome that puts all these buggers off their culinary experience."
"No, no. My great-grandfather is not up for discussion today. We have other business."
"Well, thank fuck. Repetitive syndrome is what it is."
Mickey patted his book affectionately.
"It's all in here, mate. Best $4.95 I ever spent." "Talking of moolah, you having a flutter today?"
asked Mickey, signaling downstairs.
"I am a Muslim, Mickey. I don't indulge anymore."
"Well, obviously, yeah. We're all brothers. But a man's got to live now, hasn't he? I mean, hasn't he?"
"I don't know, Mickey. Does he?"
Mickey slapped Samad firmly on the back.
"Course he does. I was saying to my brother Abdul..."
"Which Abdul?"
It was a tradition both in Mickey's wider and nuclear family to name all sons Abdul, to teach them the vanity of assuming higher status than any other man, which was all very well and good, but tended to cause confusion in the formative years. However, children are creative, and all the many Abduls added an English name as a kind of buffer to the first.
Abdul Colin.
Right.
So, you know, Abdul Colin went a bit fundamental. Eggs, beans, chips, toast. Big fucking beard. No pig, no drink, no pussy. The fucking works, mate. There you are, governor.
Abdul Mickey pushed a plate of festering carbohydrate to a sunken old man whose trousers were so high up his body they were gradually swallowing him whole.
Well, where do you think I slap eyes on Abdul Colin last week? Only in the Mickey Finn, down Harrow Roadway. And I says, "Oi, Abdul Colin, this is a fucking turn-up for the fucking books." And he says, all solemn, you know, all fully bearded, he says,
"Mickey, Mickey, do you mind very much if we leave the story for later?
It is just that..." "No, fine, fine. Wish I knew why the fuck I bother."
"If you could possibly tell Archibald, I am sitting in the booth behind the pinball when he comes in. Oh, and my usual."
"No problemo, mate."
About 10 minutes later, the door went and Mickey looked up from chapter 6. There's a fly in my soup, dealing with frameworks of hostility regarding health issues, to see Archibald Jones, cheap suitcase in hand, approaching the counter.
"All right, Arch, how's the folding business?"
"Oh, you know, commissie, commissar, some other bout."
"Is he about? Is he about? He's been hanging round like a bad fucking spell for half a fucking hour. Face as long as shit. Someone wants to get a pooper scoop and clean him up."
Archie put his suitcase on the counter and furrowed his brow.
"In a bad way, is he? Between you and me, Mickey, I'm really worried about him."
"Go tell it to the fucking mountain,"
said Mickey, who had been aggravated by Chapter 6's assertion that you should rinse plates in piping hot water.
"Or alternatively, go to the booth behind the pinball."
"Thanks, Mickey. Oh, omelette and..."
"I know, mushrooms."
Archie walked down the lino aisles of O'Connell's.
"Hello, Denzel. Evening, Clarence."
Denzel and Clarence were two uniquely rude, foul-mouthed octogenarian Jamaicans. Denzel was impossibly fat. Clarence was horribly thin. Their families had both died, they both wore trilbies, and they sat in the corner playing dominoes all the hours that were left to them.
"What did Bamba Clat say?"
"Him saying, evening."
"Can't him see me playing domino?"
"No, man. Him have a pussy for a face. How you expect him to see any little thing?"
Archie took it on the chin, as it was meant, and slipped into the booth opposite Samad.
"I don't understand,"
said Archie, picking up immediately where their phone conversation had terminated.
"Are you saying you're seeing them there in your imagination, or you're seeing them there in real life?"
"It is really very simple. The first time, the very first time, they were there. But since then, Archie, these past few weeks, I see the twins whenever I am with her, like apparitions. Even when we are, I see them there, smiling at me."
"Are you sure you're not just overworked?"
"Listen to me, Archie, I see them.
It is a sign."
"Sam,
let's try and deal with the facts. When they really saw you, what did you do?"
"What could I do? I said, 'Hello, sons. Say hello to Miss Bird Jones.'"
"And what did they say?"
"They said hello."
"And what did you say?"
"Archibald, do you think I could simply tell you what occurred without this constant inane interjection?"
"Chips, beans, egg, tomato, and mushroom."
"Sam, that's yours."
"I resent that accusation. It is not mine. I never ordered tomato. I do not want to eat some poor peeled tomato boiled to death, then fried to death.
Well, it's not mine. I asked for omelette.
Well, it is not mine. Now may I continue?
With pleasure. I looked at my boys, Archie. I looked at my beautiful boys, and my heart cracked.
No, more than this. It shattered.
It shattered into so many pieces, and each piece stabbed me like a mortal wound. I kept thinking, how can I teach my boys anything? How can I show them the straight road when I have lost my own bearings?
I thought, began Archie haltingly, that the problem was the woman. If you really don't know what to do about her, well, we could flip this coin. Heads you stay, tails you go. At least you've made a...
Samad slammed his good fist on the table.
I don't want to flip a bloody coin. Besides, it is too late for that, can't you see? What is done is done. I am hellbound, I see that now. So, I must concentrate on saving my sons. I have a choice to make. A choice of morality.
Samad lowered his voice, and even before he spoke, Archie knew to what he was about to refer.
You have made hard choices yourself, Archie, many years ago. You hid it well, but I know you have not forgotten what it is like. You have a bit of bullet in the leg to prove it. You struggled with him. You won out. I have not forgotten. I have always admired you because of it, Archibald.
Archie looked at the floor.
I'd rather not.
Believe me, I take no pleasure from dragging up that which is distasteful to you, my friend. But I am just trying to make you understand my situation. Then, as now, the question is always, what kind of a world do I want my children to grow up in? You took action on that matter once. And now, it is my turn.
Archie, making no more sense of Samad's speeches than he had 40 years ago, played with a toothpick for a moment.
Well, why don't you just stop? Well, seeing her.
I try.
That good, is it?
No, well, that is not strictly what I mean to say. It is nice, yes, but it is not debauched. We kiss, we embrace, but no, not strictly speaking, no.
But some.
Archibald, are you concerned about my sons or my sperm?
Sons, said Archie.
Definitely sons. Because there is rebellion in them, Archie, I can see it. It is small now, but it is growing. I tell you, I don't know what is happening to our children in this country. Everywhere you look, it is the same. Last week, Zeenat's son was found smoking marijuana, like a Jamaican.
Archie raised his eyebrows.
Oh, I meant no offense, Archibald.
None taken, mate. But you shouldn't judge before you've tried it. Being married to a Jamaican has done wonders for my arthritis. But that's by the by. Carry on.
Well, take Alsana's sisters.
All their children are nothing but trouble. They won't go to mosque. They don't pray. They speak strangely.
They dress strangely. They eat all kinds of rubbish. They have intercourse with God knows who. No respect for tradition. People call it assimilation when it is nothing but corruption. Corruption!
Archie tried to look shocked and then tried disgusted, not knowing what to say. He liked people to get on with things, Archie. He kind of felt people should just live together, you know, in peace or harmony or something.
Chips, beans, egg, mushroom, omelette and mushrooms.
Samad raised his hand and turned to the counter.
Abdul Mickey,
he yelled, his voice assuming a slight, comic, cockney twinge.
Over here, my governor, please.
Mickey looked at Samad, leant on the counter, and wiped his nose with his apron.
Now you know better than that. It's self-service around here, gentlemen. This ain't the fucking Waldorf.
I'll get it,
said Archie, sliding out of his seat.
How is he?
Asked Mickey under his breath, as he pushed the plate towards Archie.
Archie frowned. Dunno. He's on about tradition again. He's worried about his sons, you see. Easy for children to go off the rails in this day and age, you know. I don't really know what to say to him.
Don't have to tell me, mate,
said Mickey, shaking his head.
I wrote the fucking book, didn't I? Look at my littlest, Abdul Jimmy. Up in juvenile court next week for swiping fucking VW medallions. I says to him, you're fucking stupid or something. What the fuck is the point of that? At least steal the fucking car, if that's the way you feel about it. I mean, why? He says it's something to do with some fucking Beatty Boys or some such bollocks. Well, I says to him, that lot are dead as shit if I get hold of him. Now, I can tell you that for fucking nothing, no sense of tradition, no fucking morality is the problem.
Archie nodded and picked up a wad of napkins with which to handle the hot dishes.
If you want my advice, and you do, because that's part of the special relationship between calf owner and calf customer, you tell Samad he has two options. He can either send them back to the old country, back to India.
Bangladesh, corrected Archie,
nicking a chip from Samad's meal.
Whatever the fuck it is, he can send them back there and have them brought up proper by their granddads and grandmums, have them learn about their fucking culture, have them grow up with some fucking principles, or... 1 minute. Chips, beans, patty, and mushrooms for two.
Denzel and Clarence ever so slowly sidled up to the hot plates.
That patty looks strange, said Clarence. Him trying to poison us, said Denzel.
The mushroom look peculiar, said Clarence.
Him trying to infiltrate a good man with the devil's food, said Denzel.
Mickey slapped his egg slice down on Denzel's fingers.
Oi! Morgan and fucking Wise! Get a new fucking routine, all right?
Or what?
Persisted Archie.
I'm trying to kill an old man. An old, weak man,
muttered Denzel, as the two of them shuffled back to their seats.
Fucking hell, those two. They're only alive because they're too stingy to pay for the fucking cremation.
Or what?
What?
What's the second option?
Oh, yeah. Well, second option's obvious, isn't it?
Is it?
Accept it. He'll have to accept it, won't he? We're all English now, mate. Like it or lump it. As the rhubarb said to the custard, and that'll be 250, Archibald, my good man. The golden age of luncheon vouchers is over.
The golden age of luncheon vouchers ended 10 years ago. For 10 years, Mickey had been saying,
the golden age of luncheon vouchers is over.
And that's what Archie loved about O'Connell's. Everything was remembered. Nothing was lost. History was never revised or reinterpreted, adapted or whitewashed. It was as solid and as simple as the encrusted egg on the clock. When Archie returned to table 8, Samad was like Jeeves. If not exactly disgruntled, then some way from being gruntled.
Archibald. Did you take a wrong turn at the Ganges? Weren't you listening to my dilemma?
I am corrupt. My sons are becoming corrupt.
We are all soon to burn in the fires of hell. These are problems of some urgency, Archibald.
Archie smiled serenely and stole another chip.
Problem solved, Samad, mate.
Problem solved?
Problem solved. Now, the way I see it, you have two options.
Around the beginning of this century, the Queen of Thailand was aboard a boat, floating along with her many courtiers, manservants, maids, feet bathers, and food tasters, when suddenly the stern hit a wave, and the Queen was thrown overboard into the turquoise waters of the Nippon Kai, where, despite her pleas for help, she drowned. For not one person on that boat went to her aid. Mysterious to the outside world, to the Thai, The explanation was immediately clear. Tradition demanded, as it does to this day, that no man or woman may touch the queen. If religion is the opium of the people, tradition is an even more sinister analgesic, simply because it rarely appears sinister. If religion is a tight band, a throbbing vein and a needle, tradition is a far homelier concoction. Poppy seeds ground into tea. A sweet cocoa drink laced with cocaine. The kind of thing your grandmother might have made. To Samad, as to the people of Thailand, tradition was culture, and culture led to roots, and these were good. These were untainted principles. That didn't mean he could live by them, abide by them, or grow in the manner they demanded, but roots were roots, and roots were good. You would get nowhere telling him that weeds too have tubers, or that the first sign of loose teeth is something rotten, something degenerate, deep within the gums. Roots were what saved. The ropes one throws out to rescue drowning men, to save their souls. And the further Samad himself floated out to sea, pulled down to the depths by a siren named Poppy Burt Jones, the more determined he became to create for his boys roots on shore, deep roots that no storm or gale could displace. Easier said than done. He was in Poppy's pokey little flat, going through his own household accounts, when it became obvious to him that he had more sons than money. If he was to send them back, he would need 2 dowries for the grandparents, 2 amounts for the schooling, 2 amounts for the clothes. As it was, he could barely cover both airfares. Poppy had said, "What about your wife? She's from a rich family, isn't she?" But Samad had not yet revealed his plan to Alsana. He had only tested the water, mentioning it in a passing, hypothetical way to Clara while she did her gardening. How would she react if someone, acting in Irie's best interest, took the child away to a better life? Clara rose from her flower bed and stared at him in silent concern, and then laughed long and loud. "The man who did that," she said finally, brandishing a large pair of garden shears inches from his crotch. "Chop, chop!" "Chop, chop," thought Samad, and it became clear to him what he was going to do. "One of them?" O'Connell's again, 6:25. One chips, beans, egg and mushroom, and one omelette with mushrooms with peas, seasonal variation.
"Just one of them?"
"Archibald, please keep your voice down."
"But just one of them?"
"That is what I said. Chop, chop."
He divided the fried egg on his plate down the middle.
"There is no other way."
"But..."
Archie was thinking again, as best he could. "The same old stuff. You know, why couldn't people just get on with things, just live together, you know, in peace or harmony or something?" But he didn't say any of that. He just said,
"But..."
And then...
"But..."
And then finally,
"But which one?"
And that, if you're counting airfare, dowry, initial schooling fee, was the 3,245 quid question. Once the money was sorted, yes, he remortgaged the house, he risked his land, the greatest mistake an immigrant can make. It was simply a matter of choosing the child. For the first week, it was going to be Majid, definitely Majid. Majid had the brains. Majid would settle down quicker, learn the language quicker, and Archie had a vested interest in keeping Millat in the country, because he was the best striker Willesden Athletic FC, under-15s, had seen in decades. So Samad began stealing Majid's clothes away for surreptitious packing, arranged a separate passport. He would be traveling with Auntie Zeenat on 4th November, and had a word in the ear of the school, long holiday, could he be given some homework to take with him, etc. But then, the next week, there was a change of heart, and it was Millat, because Majid was really Samad's favorite, and he wanted to watch him grow older, and Millat was the one more in need of moral direction anyway. So his clothes were pilfered, his passport arranged, his name whispered into the right ears. The following week, it was Majid until Wednesday, and then Millat, because Archie's old pen pal, Horst Ibeldofts, wrote the following letter, which Archie, familiar now with the strangely prophetic nature of Horst's correspondence, brought to Samad's attention. 15th September, 1984. Dearest Archibald, it is some time since my last letter, but I felt compelled to write to you about a wonderful development in my garden, which has brought me no little pleasure these past few months. To make a long story shorter and sweeter, I have finally gone for the chop and removed that old oak tree from the far corner, and I cannot begin to describe to you the difference it has made. Now the weaker seeds are receiving so much more sun and are so healthy, I am able even to make cuttings from them. For the first year in my memory, each of my children has a vase of peonies on their windowsill. I had been suffering under the misapprehension all these years that I was simply an indifferent gardener, when all the time it was that grand old tree, taking up half the garden with its roots and not allowing anything else to grow. The letter went on, but Samad stopped there. Irritably, he said,
"And I am meant to divine from this precisely what?"
Archie tapped the side of his nose knowingly. "Chop, chop. It's got to be Millat. An omen, mate. You can trust Ibeldofts." And Samad, who usually had no time for omens or nose-tapping, was nervous enough to take the advice. But then Poppy, who was acutely aware that she was fading from Samad's mind in comparison with the question of the boys, suddenly took an interest, claiming to have just sensed in a dream that it should be Majid. And so it was Majid once more. Samad, in his desperation, even allowed Archie to flip a coin, but the decision was hard to stick by.
Best out of three. Best out of five.
Samad couldn't trust it. And this, if you can believe it, was the manner in which Archie and Samad went about playing lottery with two boys, bouncing the issue of the walls of O'Connell's, flipping souls to see which side came up. In their defense, one thing should be made clear. At no point was the word kidnap mentioned. In fact, had this been offered as terminology for what he was about to do, Samad would have been appalled and astounded, would have dropped the whole thing like the somnambulist who wakes up to find himself in the master bedroom with a bread knife in his hand. He understood that he had not yet informed Alsana. He understood that he had booked a 3 a.m. flight. But it was in no way self-evident to him that these two facts were related or would combine to spell out kidnap. So it was with surprise that Samad greeted the vision of a violently weeping Alsana at 2 a.m. on 31st October, hunched over the kitchen table. He did not think, "Ah, she has discovered what I am to do with Majid." It was finally and forever Majid, because he was not a mustachioed villain in a Victorian crime novel, and besides which, he was not conscious of plotting any crime. Rather, his first thought was, "So she knows about Poppy." And in response to this situation, he did what every adulterous man does out of instinct. Attack first.
"So I must come home to this, must I?"
Slam down bag for effect.
"I spend all night in that infernal restaurant, and then I am having to come back to your melodramatics?"
Alsana convulsed with tears. Some had noticed, too, that a gurgle sound was emanating from her pleasant fat, which vibrated in the gap between her sari. She waved her hands at him and then put them over her ears.
"Is this really necessary?"
asked Samad, trying to disguise his fear. He had expected anger. He didn't know how to deal with tears.
"Please, Alsana, surely this is an overreaction."
She waved her hand at him once more, as if to dismiss him, and then lifted her body a little, and Samad saw that the gurgling had not been organic, that she had been hunched over something. A radio.
"What on earth?"
Alsana pushed the radio from her body into the middle of the table and motioned for Samad to turn it up. Four familiar beeps. The beeps that follow the English into whatever land they conquer rang round the kitchen. And then, in received pronunciation, Samad heard the following.
"This is the BBC World Service at 0300 hours. Mrs. Indira Gandhi, Prime Minister of India, was assassinated today, shot down by her Sikh bodyguards in an act of open mutiny as she walked in the garden of her New Delhi home. There is no doubt that her murder was an act of revenge for Operation Blue Star, the storming of the Sikhs' holiest shrine at Amritsar last June. The Sikh community, who feel their culture is being attacked by..."
"Enough,"
said Samad, switching it off.
"She was no bloody good anyway. None of them is any bloody good. And who cares what happens in that cesspit India, dear me?"
And even before he said it, he wondered why he had to. Why he felt so malevolent this evening.
"You are genuinely pathetic. I wonder, where would those tears be if I died?"
"Nowhere."
"You care more about some corrupt politician you never met.
Do you know you are the perfect example of the ignorance of the masses, Alsi? Do you know that?"
he said, talking as if to a child and holding her chin up.
"Crying for the rich and mighty who would disdain to piss upon you. Doubtless next week you will be bawling because Princess Diana broke a fingernail."
Alsana gathered all the spit her mouth could accommodate and launched it at him.
"Benchut! I am not crying for her, you idiot! I am crying for my friends! There will be blood on the streets back home because of this, India and Bangladesh. There will be riots, knives, guns, public death. I have seen it. It will be like Mahshar Judgment Day. People will die in the streets, Samad. You know, and I know, and Delhi will be the worst of it. Is always the worst of it. I have some family in Delhi. I have friends, old lovers."
And here, Samad slapped her. Partly for the old lovers, and partly because it was many years since he had been referred to as a bhenchut. Translation, someone who, to put it simply, fucks their sisters. Alsana held her face and spoke quietly.
"I am crying with misery for those poor families, and out of relief for my own children. Their father ignores them and bullies them, yes. But at least they will not die on the streets like rats."
So this was going to be one of those rows. The same positions, the same lines, same recriminations, same right hooks. Bare fists, the bell rings, Samad comes out of his corner.
"No, they will suffer something worse, much worse. Sitting in a morally bankrupt country with a mother who is going mad. Utterly cuckoo. Many raisins short of the fruitcake. Look at you, look at the state of you. Look how fat you are."
He grabbed a piece of her and then released it as if it would infect him.
"Look how you dress. Running shoes and a sari? And what is that?"
It was one of Clara's African headscarves, a long, beautiful piece of orange kente cloth, in which Alsana had taken to wrapping her substantial mane. Samad pulled it off and threw it across the room, leaving Alsana's hair to crash down her back.
You do not even know what you are, where you come from. We never see family anymore. I am ashamed to show you to them.
Why did you go all the way to Bengal?